Thank you for downloading the IA podcast. You can listen to all our episodes on Podbean, Spotify, Apple, and YouTube. Enjoy.
The so-called Chinese economic miracle has been analysed by economists for decades. How has a nation with 88% of its population living in extreme poverty as recently as 1981 able to reduce this to a rate that less than 1%? Never in the history of the world have so many hundreds of millions of people risen from abject poverty to the middle class in such a short time. But what explains this economic miracle? How has China gone from the sick man of Asia to global superpower, catching up to the United States as the world's largest economy? I'm joined by Dr. Rainer Zeitelman, an historian and sociologist. He is also a world-renowned author, successful businessman, and real estate investor. He recently wrote a blog for the IEA on the Chinese economic miracle earlier this month, and a link to the article is in the show notes. Welcome, Rainer. Many of our listeners will be aware of the communist past of China under Chairman Mao. One policy which sticks in the mind is the Great Leap Forward, which collectivized farms to finance industrialization, which led to millions of people starving to death. But after Mao's death, Deng Xiaoping took over as the leader of the People's Republic of China. Rainer, what was the state of the Chinese economy when Xiaoping took over in 1978?
Yes, I will answer to this question, but please let me say some words about the so-called Great Leap Forward that you mentioned, because I have a lot of lectures everywhere in the world about these topics, and I see that most of the young people haven't heard anything about it and don't know anything about it. And the fact is that around 45 million people died from 1958 through 1961. And this was the biggest socialist experiment in history. And so I think it's a kind of tragedy that almost no one had heard about it, but only as a footnote. To answer your question, the economic situation after Mao's death, I think the most impressive figure is that according to World Bank, 88% of Chinese lived in extreme poverty in 1981. And you know, today the figure is less than 1%. And this is something that you should explain. So I think it's clear Mao socialism had led to absolutely a disaster in China's economy. But there's another thing to mention that is very important. The Cultural Revolution led to chaos in China. And so the party partly lost control. This allowed people in several provinces to take back freedoms that the communists had taken away from them. This is very important to understand. You know, Hayek spoke about capitalism as an order that was not created by any intellectuals or politicians, but in a spontaneous development. And I think China is a great example to prove this thesis. Things happened spontaneously. Even before Mao's death, many farmers now grew vegetables only for their own use, and large illegal markets sprang up all over the countryside. So there was a process you call decollectivization occurred. And so many people left the so-called people's communes. And in Guangzhou, for example, complete underground factories emerged. And so to say that, shortly, market economy structure spontaneously emerged everywhere. You can call it a silent revolution that took place. And of course, Deng Xiaoping played a very important role. And without Deng Xiaoping, the positive development in the last decades wouldn't have been possible. But sometimes people call him the architect of the reforms, and in a way it's true and in a way it's not. What was very important, he allowed things to happen.
Yeah, so just getting onto that, Deng Xiaoping, like you said, is credited with the policies which laid the foundation for the economic growth, which you talked about in your blog for the IA. What reforms did Deng Xiaoping put into place after Mao died?
So the first and very important thing to understand it is his way to experiment. It was not the way that he said, so now I have a new master plan and let's do it according to this master plan. First, he sent large groups of Chinese people in other countries, to Singapore, to Japan, to the United States, to Europe, and he told them, please look what works and what not. This was the first thing. So, you know, Chinese people are very curiously, and they want to learn from other people. And this was the first thing. The next thing is that he started to experiment with the so-called special economic zones. The first one was introduced in Shenzhen, what was a small village with only maybe 50,000 inhabitants at this time. Today it's 12 million people. I was there two times, and it's amazing with this entrepreneurial spirit. And this started at this time with special economic zones where they were more capitalist than we are here in the Western world. And what they saw, it worked. And so if you want to understand what Deng Xiaoping did, first, he allowed this spontaneous process I spoke before to happen. The next thing that he made these experiments and the special economic zones. And of course, then the next steps were that at the 14th Party Congress in 1992, the Communist Party officially proclaimed the market economy as the goal of the reforms, and private property was introduced, and there were price reform, labor market reform, tax reform, foreign trade reform, and but all this not from one day to the other, but it was a slow process, reducing the role of the state and introducing private property and implementing more market elements, but not from one day to another, but in a process. And this process was not always going in one direction. There was always a fight between what I call the capitalist and the socialist approach in China. Always there were these different factions in the party, and these different approaches. There was always a fight, and I think this still goes on. And so it was not always going in one direction. And another thing was very important. Deng Xiaoping started his reform with a very important slogan. And this slogan was, let some people become rich first. So to become rich was a positive thing. And you see it today in China. I give you one number. I had a survey. I commissioned a survey now in 11 countries about how people in different countries see rich people and how important is it for them to become rich. And when we asked people, how important is it for you to become rich, on average in Western countries, Europe and the United States, it was 28% who said it was important for them. In China, the number is 50%. In South Korea, 58%. And in Vietnam, it's even 76%. So this is the difference. And so I think it started, if you go to China, I had a lot of lectures there about how to become rich and so, and these things. And there was no one who questioned whether this is a good idea to become rich or not. The only thing that people wanted to know how to grow rich, how to become rich. And I think this change in the attitude, especially towards rich people, was very important. And you see, as a result, when the reform started, there was no single billionaire, and maybe even not many, or if at all, any millionaires in China. Today, we have more billionaires in China than in any other country in the world, with except United States, where some are. But today, there are more billionaires in Beijing than in New York, Manhattan. And on the other hand, you see, this is very important to understand, these two developments. The rate of people in extreme poverty was reduced from 88% to less than 1%. And at the same time, the number of millionaires and billionaires grows. So, and this, I think this is this proves that all this zero-sum thinking, where socialists believe in that rich people can only become rich because they have taken it away from the poor, that it's totally wrong. But because if it would be true, how could this happen that at the same time, the rate of poverty is reduced so much, and the rate of people who are very rich is rising at the same time?
Yeah. So your article looked at work authored by Zhang Weiying. He analyzed data from different regions across China, and he concluded that the more market-oriented reform a province had implemented, the higher economic growth it achieved. Do you want to discuss a bit more about that? Because there was sort of, you know, like you were saying, Deng Xiaoping, it was an experimental process, and sometimes the state was in and the private sector was out, and in other provinces, the private sector was in and the state was out. Could you explain a bit more about that?
Yes. First, to explain, Zhang Weiying is a very smart economist at Beijing University. I met him in Beijing, and I spoke with him, and he repeated one sentence again and again. He said, if you want to understand the progress in China, then it's very important to understand that it was not because of the state, but in spite of the state. And he said, this is what a lot of people, Western people, don't understand. And the problem is that even today, a lot of people in China don't understand it. They call it, they think they that there is something like a special China model, what is a mixture between capitalism and socialism. And of course, it is a mixture, as in every other country as well. In the UK, it's a mixed system of capitalism and socialism, or in Germany, where I live, in the United States, you have everywhere mixed systems. But I think what is very important to understand, and this is the same approach that Zhang Weiying has and that I have, I call it the test tube theory. I will explain what I mean with this. Imagine you have a test tube with two ingredients, market and state, or capitalism and socialism. And then you look what happened if you add more market, as people in China did in the last four decades. You see, then you have more economic welfare, people get better. Or on the contrary, you add more state, as they did in the last 20 years in Venezuela, for example. And then look what happened then. Or I think you know it from the UK, when Maggie Thatcher added more market. You see what happened. And this was what in China happened. And I think one of the most important insights from the research from Wang Chang over the several provinces is, and I give you a quote here, the best measure of reform progresses is the changes in marketization scores in the concerned periods rather than the absolute scores of a particular year. This is very important, because not only to understand what happened in different cities or districts in China, but in general to understand the economy. The ratio between state and market is not so important if you want to understand the development. Much more important are the changes in the ratio, what I call this test tube theory, whether you add more market or you add more state. And his analysis had a very clear result. I give you another quote, what he wrote. He wrote, the provinces whose economies are more privatized are likely to grow faster. It is non-state sectors rather than the state sector that have driven the high growth. And I think this is very important. And okay, if you some people see, okay, the state has an important role in China. This is true, but I think it's clear if you come from a situation where the state controlled 100%, and even if you reduce the role of the state to 90%, 80%, 70%, 60%, of course, you see always large state, but this is not the important thing. The important thing is that you have to understand that the progress is due to the reduction of the state.
Yeah, so I think you wrote in your blog that, you know, we can't see the economic miracle because of the state, but because where the state was not involved, as you were saying. Just to finish, I think it's important to reiterate that, because a lot of politicians, left-leaning, look to China and say, look, this is a model where we can have economic success and the state does play a role. And just to finalize, that's not correct, is it? The state in China was not the reason for economic success. And one thing I'd like to touch on as well, you mentioned in some articles that you sent over Milton Friedman visiting China and sort of seeing a lot of his ideas in practice. Could you talk about that?
Yes. Before I come to Milton Friedman, tell me something that is very important. I have a research paper from World Economic Forum. It's from 2 years ago, and maybe the numbers are not 100% correct now. But to understand why a lot of people in the West overestimate the role of the state in China, I give you only 3 or 4 numbers. 60% of GDP in China is from the private sector, and the private sector contributes to 70% of innovation, 70% of investments, 80% of urban exports, and provides 90% of new jobs. Yes, and this is what people don't understand. I read a lot in newspapers in Germany. This is all a planned economy, and the state does everything. This is a large misunderstanding, and it's dangerous, because if you have this wrong analysis, then you have wrong results, because people think, okay, if China is so successful because they have such a large role of the state, maybe then we should have in our Western countries a more a larger role of the state as well. And so this is the reason why it's so dangerous. But you asked me about Milton Friedman. Milton Friedman was the first one who understood the development in China. He was there. He was there in 1980, and he was a second time there in 1988. At this time, things were more free in China than they are today. You see this, for example, they had from the Cato Institute, they organized a conference in Shanghai in 1988. I think this would not be possible today. At this time, most of the economists, or a lot of them, were Milton Friedman or Hayek fans in China. But this changed. I think Chiang Wang today is a little bit more like an outsider, what was not the case at this time. And I give you one quote from Milton Friedman that shows his insight he said in 1988, he said, it is a tribute to the current leaders of China that they are engaged in a serious effort to make the transition. The Chinese people would be the main, but by no means the only beneficiaries of the success of this effort. All the people of the world would benefit it. And I think these are almost prophetic words, because the rapid growth in China, I think, let's take example, Germany with our car industry. I think today the development in China is much more important than the development inside Germany. And I think for the growth worldwide of the economy, China is so important. And so Milton Friedman saw it before. But in one way, maybe he was a little bit too optimistic at first, not in the end, because he hoped that the introduction of pro-market reform and more capitalism will lead to more political freedom. And, you know, it was not true, and we don't know whether it will be ever will be true. I think he thought, because he had the experience in Chile with Pinochet, what was a cruel dictatorship, and then but he started with economic reforms, and later on, you know, after Pinochet, his successors followed on with his economic reforms, but in a democratic and free Chile. And I think maybe he thought that something similar will happen in China. But I think today we see in China, these are two different things. The one thing is the economy, and the other things are politics. And maybe, of course, if you look in history, very often capitalism and democracy were linked to each other, but maybe it's not something like a law that this is always the case. These are not good news for you know, people who love freedom, but maybe the experiment in China proves this.
Thank you, Dr. Rena Zeitelman. That's all we've got time for. Thank you to our listeners for joining us today. I hope you'll join us again soon.
Thank you for listening. If you like what you heard, please subscribe to the IA podcast on Podbean, Spotify, or Apple. We also upload our podcast on our YouTube channel, IEA London. If you want to help contribute to the IEA's digital output, please support us on Patreon, where you can benefit from exclusive membership perks whilst helping us continue to produce stimulating educational output. To become an online patron, click the link in the show notes.